from sea to shining sea across this great land of ours and around the world on the internet. This is Coast to Coast AM. My name is Rob Simone, and I am tickled pink to be back in the seat with you. I am honored and thrilled that I get to spend a Saturday with everyone listening, and especially because the show we have teed up tonight is absolutely amazing. What we're going to do tonight is really tackle the question of what's going on above our heads, the sun, the moon, the stars, and it in a way in which we really haven't done on this program before. And the first hour, we're going to get into a strange phenomenon that the Hubble telescope picked up some while ago. We're going to talk with Professor Jim Bell. And he is someone who knows all things astronomical. In fact, he was the winner of the Carl Sagan Medal from the American Astronomical Society. And he's going to talk to us about this comet, this asteroid that broke up and was captured by the images from the Hubble Space Telescope. And it was absolutely stunning. Some of these pieces that you can see in the video are actually bigger than the Earth itself. Now, that video is linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. And in the 11 o'clock hour, second guest is someone who has an interesting theory about the sun and the moon. Mark Blitz, who wrote a book called Blood Moons. And it dives into the area of how the moon can be prophetic. And maybe it's telling us more than we think. Now, a lot of people who've listened to this program know that we've talked about the Mayan calendar quite a bit and how our current calendar was given to us by some of our religious leaders and isn't really synced up to the natural world. So the Mayan calendar seems like, well, the great way to go, right? It's hooked up to the moon and you're in the sync, natural rhythms of the universe. Well, no, says Mark Blitz. It actually should be a calendar that incorporates the sun and the moon. And he's going to talk about how there are signs in the eclipses and the blood moons that happen every so often that have heralded major events. And there's some coming up in the future that he's going to talk to you about that I think are pretty interesting. Now, as I look at the news, this flight from Malaysia is still missing. And it doesn't bode well at this point. The thing popped off radar, and we just, you know, have to think about the families and send our best to them because it doesn't look like this one's coming back. So anything that comes up during the show, any late breaking news, I will certainly keep you abreast of. And, you know, the situation in Kiev is also one of these things that is troubling. But I'm reminded of this day in history. That's right. If you go back to 1983, on this very day, Ronald Reagan, speaking at the National Association of Evangelicals, referred to the Soviet Union as the evil empire. A historic day in the annals of the presidency. And I wonder if we're not floating back into that mentality. And if we are, what does that say about where things are going? You know, we listen to the show, and the show's all about sort of opening up your mind to new realities. So I hope that we can do just that. And I hope people are listening around the world, and I hope that we can sort of raise the consciousness here and just crank open the aperture of mind, because it works better that way when we get some perspective. And we're going to dive into it. We're going to talk about some of these interesting anomalies with our guest Jim Bell. And I'm also going to talk to him about the Martian rover Spirit Opportunity. These things have been going on years, in some cases, after they were supposed to fizzle out on the Martian surface. And there's all kinds of interesting details I want to get into. And we're going to dive in. You're listening to Coast AM. Stay right there. Quick break. We're coming right back. All right. We are back on Coast to Coast AM. And I've been pretty busy. Since the last time I hosted Coast to Coast, I was out at the International UFO Congress. I spoke there about UFOs in the headlines. And, of course, George Norrie was out there, too. And I wasn't sure what he was going to talk about. I didn't know what his sort of lecture was going to be. And I was walking around the hallway, and I was walking past the main room, the main lecture room, and I heard this roar going on. I thought, wow, what's going on in there? Popped my head in. Sure enough, it's George on stage, literally just doing stand-up comedy for an hour. And the audience was just rolling. I am in awe and quite envious of someone who can get up with just a microphone and make people laugh for an hour. I have to say, it was extremely entertaining. And after that, I zipped up to Sedona for a while. I love Sedona. Literally the most beautiful place in the United States. If you've never been there, you simply have to go. And it's a power center. Whatever you want, whatever you're looking for, whatever's on your mind, manifest more quickly there. You go, you'll see what I mean. And of course, I started my career in Sedona back in the 90s. I was working with Peter Gersten, the UFO lawyer, suing the government to get information about this UFO conspiracy. And that we did using the Freedom of Information requests. And we got a ton of stuff. In fact, you know, there was a court case in Phoenix federal court that went on for a while. One of the cases was appealed all the way to the Supreme Court, still uses a precedent today. And that's how I got into this amazing field. I mean, I wanted to get involved and I wanted to volunteer. So I moved out there for a year on my own dime, found a place and in the middle of nowhere, out in the bush with little scorpions, rattlesnakes and javelinas running around everywhere. And my little ham radio, I used to talk to the different people out there. That's where I got my license. And because I was traveling around the world, they didn't have cell phones like they do today. And I tell you, that thing saved my ass more than a few times. If you're thinking about it, you should definitely become a ham. It is fun. They're the greatest people. And they're the smartest people, too. They're all engineers. And just, you know, if you ever want to talk technical talking, just fire up your ham radio and you'll be in good hands. So spent some time in Sedona. And after that, shot up to the Hopi Reservation and visited with a few friends. I was up there a few times before interviewing some of the elders. And it's just magic up there. And I always try and go up there and help out any way I can. So, yeah, been pretty busy, but I'm back, and I'm really looking forward to the show. And let's bring on our first guest, Jim Bell, Professor Jim Bell, because there is this strange thing that I think really caught the attention of some of the astronomers that was captured on the Hubble Space Telescope. And to help us figure it out, we're going to talk to Jim. Jim, welcome to Coast to Coast AM.
Hey, thanks, Rob. It's great to be on the show.
Thanks for coming on. Now, you've seen this video that's linked up now at coasttocoastam.com. And when did this first come to your attention?
You know, this I remember hearing about this in a meeting. It must have been last year at an astronomy conference. These researchers had detected from the ground this asteroid in the main asteroid belt. So it's out. It's not close to the Earth. It's out between Mars and Jupiter. It's out near, approaching about three times as far from the Earth as from the Sun. And they saw this, normally asteroids are single points of light in a telescope. That's what the word means, and star-like. And instead of a single point, they saw multiple points of light, all following the same orbit. And it was interesting enough that they applied for and got some time on the Hubble Space Telescope, which has much clearer view of the universe than telescopes on the ground. It's not looking through our atmosphere. And when they did that, they saw, you know, dozens or 10 or 12 or so separate chunks of this asteroid, all very slowly moving apart from each other in their orbit around the sun, as you can see in the movie. So
this asteroid it's in our solar system, right? It's in the asteroid belt?
That's right. It's orbiting the sun. It's there's more than 600,000 asteroids that are now known, and the orbits are known out there in our solar system. And this is one of them, orbits between Mars and Jupiter. And it appears to have broken up relatively recently into a bunch of pieces. And each of those pieces now has its own little dust tail, like a comet. And they're slowly moving apart from each other. And so it tells us that the solar system is a dynamic place. It's not like they used to imagine back in Isaac Newton and Copernicus's day, that it was like a clockwork like it can be chaotic. Things happen that we can observe with telescopes on the ground from the Earth and with these amazing space missions like NASA.
Everything's crashing in everything else.
Lots of impacts happening.
Yeah.
You know, you look at the moon and you can see these big circular holes that tell us that the moon was hit by asteroids and comets over time. So was the Earth. Earth was hit a lot over time, and there's still a few hundred impact craters left on Earth, including the spectacular one in northern Arizona, of course, that you're probably familiar with.
Sure.
Crater.
Yeah.
And but Earth is our planetary surface is so young and dynamic. We have plate tectonics and erosion and glaciers and oceans and things that erode the surface heavily. So that history of impacts that's preserved on the moon, where there's no atmosphere, it's just not preserved on our planet.
Mm. Now, is this the first time the Hubble actually captured some kind of event like this?
It is, although it's similar in some ways to you and listeners may remember back in 1994, there was a comet that was discovered that passed very close to Jupiter. Actually, it was discovered in 93, and it was captured by Jupiter's gravity and broken up into 20 different pieces. And in the summer of 1994, this comet, which was called Shoemaker-Levy 9, crashed into Jupiter one piece after another. And that was another example of an object that was broken apart by some process, gravity of Jupiter in this case, and the world's astronomers and people on this relatively new form of communication at the time called the Internet were watching these cometary pieces crash into Jupiter, making these enormous explosions.
Yeah, I remember that. They were massive. I mean, the magnitude would be many nuclear bombs, right?
Oh, very much so. It was much more power than the entire arsenal of human nuclear weapons that was released in those impacts.
Wow.
Yep.
Now,
nature is a force to be reckoned with, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, it absolutely is. Well, does this pose any, I don't know, I want to say threat, but when we see these things breaking up and colliding, does that mean that they can actually be pushed out of this belt and perhaps spin in our direction in some of the pieces, or is that whole area pretty much self-contained and holding its own gravity with each other?
Yeah. No, what you described actually does happen. You know, there are impacts and other forces that move, gravitational forces that move bodies around in the main belt and elsewhere in the solar system. And in fact, that's how we get the meteorites in our collection. You know, the world's collection of tens of thousands of meteorites comes from little asteroids and pieces of comets, and you know, leaving their nice safe orbits and encountering the Earth and crashing into the Earth. Of course, these crashes tend to be very, very small. The pieces left behind are very small, but occasionally they're big, like the one that happened in Chelyabinsk last February in Russia.
The
very large fireball that broke all those windows, injured so many people. So in fact, it does. You know, it is that fact that they're mostly confined between Mars and Jupiter, but there's a population of them that orbit very close to the Earth. Occasionally, they do encounter the Earth or the Moon or the other planets. And that's why NASA is working so hard to categorize and classify and find these, do a census of them. In fact, it's a congressional mandate. It's mandated by Congress that NASA identify all of these so-called potentially hazardous asteroids. Because, you know, if a big one, you know, made an impact on the Earth, it could be a very, very bad day. It was certainly a bad day 65 million years ago when an impact crater likely ended the age of the dinosaurs.
Yeah.
So it's really worth our effort. We're the first species on the planet that can actually do this, detect these things ahead of time. And so if we're smart and worried about our long-term survival, we should pay attention to this possible threat.
Yeah, here. Well, the Hubble telescope, tell me about its range. I mean, what's the closest thing it can focus on? The moon? The Earth?
Yeah, Hubble has actually observed the moon.
Okay.
It's not very frequent, but there have been some Hubble observations of the moon.
Okay.
And then, of course, the most distant things Hubble can look at go way back to nearly the beginning of the observable universe.
Yeah.
10 billion light years or more away. So it's really just a fabulous machine for astronomy. both close to home and solar system, like the kind of astronomy and planetary science that I do, as well as the more typical astrophysics, stars, galaxies, cosmology.
Mm. And so if the Hubble is doing a deep field photograph and it's looking at a distant galaxy, it's really looking back in time because we're seeing
Absolutely.
How that galaxy looked, what, a million years ago?
But it depends. I mean, the closest galaxy to our own is the Andromeda galaxy, which is 2 million light years away. That's the closest one to us.
So, yeah.
And you can see that with the naked eye on a clear night, northern hemisphere, depending on the season.
Yeah.
When you're looking at that galaxy, you're looking at light that left that galaxy 2 million years ago.
Yes.
And that's the closest one. So Hubble can see back billions of years, actually.
Yeah.
Very close to the early history of it.
I love that. Well, can the Hubble look at the Martian surface and focus in and get really good detail?
Absolutely.
Has it?
Before the current age of so many orbiters and landers and rovers on the surface, I was involved with other colleagues in using Hubble to map the surface of Mars, to monitor the weather. There's clouds and seasons and polar caps on Mars, and we get very good detail on Mars from the Hubble telescope. Of course, a lot of that is now made somewhat obsolete because we have spacecraft in orbit taking super high-resolution pictures and other measurements of landers, rovers driving around looking at rocks and sand dunes, and mineral deposits, things like that. So while Hubble can look at Mars, it doesn't look very much at Mars anymore because we've got such a massive spacecraft presence there, right there in that environment.
Mm-hmm.
But Hubble looks at the other planets as well. We don't have those kinds of spacecraft on all the other planets. But
yeah,
we use the telescope to look at them as well.
Well, I was under the impression that Hubble was finding like 5-6 sort of inhabitable planets a month. Is that?
So there's a complementary mission to Hubble called Kepler, which is another space telescope that is up in Earth orbit or near Earth orbit, and that mission was designed to find these Earth-like planets around other stars. But just looking at a few hundred thousand in astronomy of stars in the neighborhood of the Sun, and that mission has identified huge numbers of them, thousands of stars known to have planets now. And Hubble is one of the instruments that can follow up on that. So if the Kepler mission finds evidence of a planet, then Hubble or big ground-based telescopes like the Keck telescopes in Hawaii can point at those planets and get much more time, much more detail, maybe measuring their atmospheres or trying to get their sizes, confirming their existence also. It's good to have proof from multiple instruments instead of just one.
Hmm.
What is
the ballpark figure for sort of somewhat inhabitable planets that we've discovered so far?
You know, it's NASA just announced 700 more, I think, a week or so ago, 10 days maybe ago, and I think that puts the number up above a couple of thousand. And these are just in a very tiny piece of the sky that's close to our solar system. The survey has been a very tiny survey. And so what you can do, Rob, is you can extrapolate. You can say, okay, if we look at this little tiny piece of the sky and we see a couple of thousand planets, probably more coming, they're still processing the data, then what must there be across the entire sky? And that number is actually staggering. Something like 100 billion planets in our galaxy alone. Something like, 30, 40 million to more Earth-like planets in our environment, in our galaxy. And our galaxy, of course, is just one of hundreds of millions of galaxies. So it seems like from these recent discoveries, it seems like planets around stars are common, and it seems like Earth-like planets around stars might also be common. So somewhere out there are other Earth-like planets, and astronomers worldwide are working hard to try to find them and look for any evidence of signs of life.
Well, if that is not a place to put it on pause, I can't think of a better one. This is Coast to Coast AM. We're going to come right back, talk with Jim Bell about what's going on Mars and what these rovers are up to, what they photographed, and what are the chances that they have or can find life on the red planet. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM. Stay right there. We're coming back. Because the answers to humanity and the focus of our ancient ancestors has always been to the stars. Because ultimately, that's our destiny. And there is no qualification I got to make. I mean, literally, it's that simple. We're just beginning to sort of crawl out of our adolescence of humanity. We're just putting on one shoe at a time here. And the answers are out there, literally. I mean, we are now just discovering, as you just heard in the last half hour, that there are thousands of inhabitable planets. And we're finding 20 or 30 more every single month. So what it comes down to is that there is an age of discovery happening right now. And if you're listening to the show, you are part of the army that's helping to make it happen. My guest is Professor Jim Bell, and he is the winner of the Carl Sagan Medal from the American Astronomical Society. We're talking about what's going on the Martian surface, the rovers, and later in the 11 o'clock hour, we're having Mark Blitz on. And he's the author of Blood Moons. We're going to talk about celestial prophecy and what these blood moons and these eclipses have to tell us about historical events and perhaps future events. There's a lot going on. Stay right there. Quick break. We're coming right back. Welcome back to Coast AM. This is Rob Simone, and I am talking to you about this enigma in space and some of the exploration that we have done. Now, I referenced last half hour, Jim Bell was talking to us about this video that the Hubble telescope captured of this asteroid falling apart with these massive pieces that are bigger than the Earth. That video is linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. And if you missed it, I really got to tell you that you should become a Coast Insider, because not only can you hear all the shows without commercials, but you can go back 3 years and listen to all the shows. You get Somewhere in Time with Art Bell, classic shows, and it's all as easy as ever to do. You get the mobile apps that are free for Android and iPhone, and it's about $5 a month, something like that, less than a sandwich. So if you are interested in really getting the best of Coast, become an insider. Just go to coasttocoastam.com right now, and you'll see it there, and you'll get all the info that's waiting for you. Well, Jim, welcome back to the program. We talked a little bit about what's happening kind of in our local area and about the different planets, but I'm really interested in Mars because you have been working on the rover program for how many years now?
Going back to, I was involved in the first rover sent to Mars back in 1997.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the current rover Opportunity has been active on Mars for more than 10 years. And the Curiosity rover, which was landed just in 2012, is also still active and very productive.
Hmm. What about Spirit?
Spirit is no longer working. Okay. Spirit, like Opportunity, was supposed to last 90 days on Mars. It lasted 2,210 and stopped working in March of 2010. It was succumbed to very dusty solar panels. Spirit Opportunity was solar powered, and Mars has these famous dust storms, of course, and get those panels very dusty. But Opportunity rover is in a much less dusty place, and we get lucky once in a while, and the wind blows the dust off the solar panels, and that rover is working great. It's today is day 3,598.
Unbelievable.
Of our 90-day mission on Mars. So that's some spectacular American engineering.
Planet. What a great use of our tax dollars right there. Best example. Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you about it, because you have to forgive me, everyone, because I'm going to geek out right now. This is such an opportunity. Okay, the solar panels that you guys use, are they the kind of solar panels that I can buy and for my iPod, or you guys have special solar panels that are not even available to the public?
You know, some of the tech, I mean, these rovers, of course, were launched back in 2003. And at the time, those solar panels were very high tech. They were the cutting edge of technology for solar power. You know, on the Earth here, that technology has advanced significantly. And part of that advancement is fueled by NASA projects like this, you know, the innovations and the technological discoveries needed to send a robot to work on another planet, help us here on the Earth with solar panels or battery technologies. The batteries are the same way. They're the same kind of technology that shows up in your cell phone, your smartphone, and other battery cars, and et cetera. So these technologies do trickle down. They do. And while, you know, that technology is no longer high tech sitting on Mars, today, it has led to many of the high-tech advances that we have now in solar panels and batteries.
Okay. So the ones that you sent up several years ago, that technology is somewhat available as far as the solar panels go?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And it's just gotten better.
Yeah.
Solar panel efficiency continues to improve, and you're seeing more and more power companies across the country get a larger fraction of their power from solar because that efficiency is improving.
Yeah. What about the batteries? Are these lithium-ion batteries, or what kind of batteries?
They are. That technology was first demonstrated in these NASA missions, and now these are widely available around the world, of course, and the amount of power you can store in these little batteries is just improving over time as that technology matures.
Yeah. So here's my question. You have these solar panels that really are the top surface of these rovers, and when they're clean, I saw a recent documentary about how one of the rovers was pretty much dead, and then a wind came and knocked some of the dust off, and this thing sprang back to life. Why can't you guys just put a window wiper on this thing?
And it's great. Everybody asks this question. It's a great question, Ron. And it's not because the engineers can't design it. It's because, you know, these missions were designed to last 90 days. And, you know, we wanted to achieve everything we could do in that 90 days. That's what the manufacturers warranty from engineers at Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena gave us.
Okay.
And we said, well, what about the panels getting dusty? And they said, well, okay, we can, if you want to put a wiper on or a compressed air or some way to clean the panels up, we can do that. But there's only so much mass and volume we can fit in the rocket. And so you're going to have to trade that for something. What do you want to trade for your wiper blades? You want to get rid of an extra transmitter? You want to get rid of a camera? You know, you want to get rid of some other science instrument? And we thought a lot about that and decided not to make that trade. Let the panels get dusty. And they said the rovers will last at least 90 days, and they did. And we kept a full complement of redundant transmitters and science instruments and all that. And so it was a conscious choice. And lo and behold, the engineers were so good that these things lasted much, much longer than we had ever dreamed.
Well, it just sounds like the corporate culture sort of coming in. I mean, if you're spending $1 billion to send a bit of hardware up there, I would think you might want to go the last mile and put especially if you know that you can get 10 times more life out of it with a simple operation, because you have motors on this thing. You have these arms that move up and down and left and right. So you know that it's capable of operating in that environment for extended periods of time.
It's a zero-sum game. It's a zero-sum game. That's the thing. You can only send so much mass in a rocket. And so if you want to do something else, you got to trade that. And so you always have to make these conscious choices, these trades. Do you take this risk? Do you take that risk? And I think it's worked out okay for us, actually.
Well, okay, if the margins are that tight, what did you have to get rid of then? What are the things that you wanted to put on but couldn't? I mean, the wiper aside.
Well, we of course wanted larger rovers that were more capable, that could go farther. We wanted to carry, more bigger batteries so we could heat the rovers better and survive longer. We actually had an additional science instrument that we wanted to carry along that we couldn't because of its mass and its cost. And it's not just mass, it's dollars are a constrained thing as well. We have to be very, very, penny pinching on what we're spending and making sure we justify every dollar. And so, we wanted to fly the launch much more capable rovers than we ended up launching, but that's always the way it is. You go to Mars with the rover you can launch. and what you can fit in the in that rocket and within the budget. And you know, there's a lot of pressure, of course, to stay within the budget.
Sure. What area of Mars, if any area is possible, would be the most interesting to put another rover on?
You know, there's it's a big planet. It's almost as hard to answer that question as it is to imagine yourself as an alien scientist saying, if I could just send one mission to the Earth, where would it go? You know, it's, our planet is so diverse, and so is Mars. There are enormous volcanoes. There are gigantic canyons. There's huge fields of sand dunes. There's craters, you know, polar caps. There's lots and lots to see. I personally would like us to be able to get a rover or lander into those giant canyons. That there's the big canyon on Mars called Ballast Marineris stretches from the equivalent of from New York to Los Angeles if it was on the Earth. It's an enormous rip in the crust that exposes all these layered rocks. And just like in the Grand Canyon, if you want to understand the history of the Earth, you go to a place like the Grand Canyon and you walk up or down and you study those layers of time, and those layers are exposed for us in places like the canyons on Mars. And that's sort of what the Curiosity rover is doing right now, is studying a place where all these layers are exposed inside of a big impact crater. And so we're, you know, trying to act like geologists on the Earth would and go to those special places where, like you were talking about Sedona, where the rocks are all exposed to you and you can see the history of the planet sort of recorded in its geology.
Right. Well, is there any volcanic energy left in Mars in the inside, or is it just completely dead?
Well, that's a great question. We don't know the answer to that question, actually. There's been no obvious evidence of eruptions that we've seen in the 30, 40 years we've been looking closely at the planet with NASA spacecraft. But we just don't know deep down inside. And so there's NASA's next lander mission launching in 2016. Mm-hmm. We'll have a seismometer on board. It's called the InSight mission. We'll land and deploy a seismometer and look for Mars quakes and look for any evidence that the interior might still be active. So I wish we knew, but we don't know. So we'll design an experiment to go figure it out.
Well, if there was some kind of magma, wouldn't it create a magnetic field? And if so, wasn't there any satellites that have magnetometers? Is there any trace of a magnetosphere?
Yes, there is a trace of a magnetic field on Mars. It's a very, very tiny one right now, but but there are places on the surface that have strong, what we call remnant magnetic fields. They preserve what used to be a much stronger magnetic field a long time ago. Just some isolated places. So it tells us that most likely, as you just indicated, Mars did have a strong magnetic field, molten interior early in its history. But it's a smaller planet than the Earth, and so it cools off faster. And so maybe it's not unreasonable to think that it has cooled off, that its interior is not active anymore, and that's why it doesn't have a magnetic field. But we just don't know. And, you know, nature surprises us all the time, which is why we want to make these measurements and study the place and, of course, learn more about how our own planet works by studying the neighboring planets around us.
Sure. Well, there's water on Mars, right? A lot of water?
Absolutely. Lots of water ice. Mm-hmm. A little bit of water vapor in the atmosphere, and possibly, we don't know for certain, but possibly subsurface water, maybe, you know, aquifers.
Yes.
We just don't know that. That's future missions we're going to have to tell. But we have detected a lot of ice and, of course, some water vapor in the atmosphere. There is water there.
Yeah, that's my question. Now, if there's water underneath the surface and perhaps there's some sort of relief from the extremes from night and day, is it possible with liquid water shielded somewhat from the bombardment of the sun and everything, that because the building blocks of life are just as present on the Martian surface as everywhere else, scattered, the amino acids, everything else, is it possible and or likely, in your opinion, that there is some sort of basic building block of life where there is water on Mars?
You know, this is one of the great discoveries, I think, in the last few decades of astronomy and space science, and that is that rovers and orbiters and other missions have found that Mars was a habitable environment, that there are places where liquid water, heat sources, maybe organic molecules all came together, and those are the big three that you need for life as we know it.
And so the answer is, yes, it is possible. The conditions could be right deep down underground, where it gets warmer as you go deeper into the surface, where it could be still geologically active down there. We don't know. There could be water, liquid water down there. We know there's ice close to the surface. It could turn to water. There could be a groundwater system there. And organic molecules are constantly rained on the planets from asteroids and comets all the time, like the asteroid we talked about earlier in the show. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it is a potentially habitable environment.
Yeah.
But what we don't know, but what we want to find out desperately, is it inhabited? Mm. Not just habitable, but is it inhabited? And to do that, you know, we have missions like Curiosity, which can detect organic molecules. We haven't unambiguously detected any Martian complex organic molecules with that mission yet, but it's really cool to be driving around with a machine and an instrument that could detect those things. And, you know, it may be the case that we ultimately have to go there with much more capable robots or people and drill. And drill down, get deep into the subsurface, and find those environments where life could exist. It's pretty exciting. It really is pretty exciting.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you another geeky type question, because I'm really into radio. Tell me about how these rovers communicate. Now, what frequency do they use, and how much wattage? And are they pointed directly at the Earth, or is there a repeater through a satellite? How does the radio signal actually get to Earth?
Yeah, they use radio communication. NASA has a whole set of reserve frequencies in some part of the radio band. I don't actually know what frequency it is, but NASA has reserve frequencies for spacecraft. There's 30 or 40 spacecraft all over the solar system, actually, that are communicating through the deep space network antennas that NASA has. And so they'll take their measurements, take pictures, for example, and just like, you know, broadcast television, those pictures get converted into a digital signal, ones and zeros. And that digital signal then can either be broadcast back to the Earth directly with a high gain antenna, it's called. It takes a lot of power to do that.
Yeah.
Or we can relay through these orbiters that NASA has around Mars, and it takes much less power to do that. So it's almost always been that we've sent the pictures and other data back through relay. But they're very weak signals, a few tens of watts. You know, it takes these giant, you know, 200-foot radio telescopes. There's one in California, one in Australia, one in Spain that NASA runs. Mm. It takes a telescope that size to detect these tiny, tiny signals. But the frequency is well known. So
yeah,
long as you can point the thing in the right direction, know when it's broadcasting, and we're pretty good about timing those things, we get those signals back. So it's very much like broadcast television in the way that they transmit their data.
Yeah. Mars is like all hooked up. It's all got this whole radio thing bouncing around.
It is really slow compared to, you know, internet or people's Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
You know, it's not quite dial up.
Right.
Remember those days.
So, it's not ESPN, but
No.
Let me ask you about another great mystical, mysterious thing. The tower on the moon, Phobos. Have you seen pictures of this very strange-looking, dimensional, artificial-looking tower that's on that strange moon?
No, I have not seen pictures of that. But the Phobos itself is certainly a pretty spectacular place. And it's we take pictures of Phobos with the rovers and with the spacecraft in orbit around Mars fairly frequently. Mm-hmm. And so there's, you know, a whole bunch of geologists and astronomers who study those pictures as well. But I haven't seen those pictures.
Yeah. Well, Jim Bell, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for coming on. And let me pick your brain about what's happening on the Martian surface. So many great questions. And I want to, of course, direct people to check out some of your work. You have authored some books about space from the beginning to the end of time. And your information is hooked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. Coming up next, Mark Blitz and the Celestial Prophecies. My name is Rob Simone. Stay right there. We're coming back.